I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
Well, it's good to be back, Michael, and plenty of stories to tell.
Well, I imagine you have, as our regular and dedicated listeners know. You've been traipsing around the world. Well, that's a little exaggerated. You've been in France. You've been learning lots of things, no doubt. Martin, I trust your business travels were successful, and of course, President Macron, after the recent EU Parliament elections, decided he'd better call an election early. Did you get a surprise when you heard that, and why do you think he did it?
It was a stunning surprise, and it's been the talk of all France ever since it's happened. So a little bit of context, Michael, they had the European elections and the far right did quite well in France. They had patchy results across the EU. In fact, the centre did okay. The Greens lost some traction. The far right did better than they had done previously. But in France, they did especially well. And it seemed to unnerve some people in France, of course. And the president, who was on the back foot, decided that he would suddenly call a snap election years before it was due for their National Assembly. Just to be clear, it's not a presidential election. So there's no, his position doesn't change, but it's for his parliament, for his national parliament. And there's only a 3-week election. So it's a really short period of time. There's almost no time for people to campaign. The left have agreed that they're going to work together and they've signed a joint manifesto, as you do in those parts. And the common consensus around the place is that he's written his own political suicide note because his own party is going to be wiped out and the far right will take most of his seats and he's going to find Parliament impossible to work with. So it's an astonishing development.
So he must have thought, as you're implying, that in the light of that, he'd snap an election on the people and they'd all come to their senses. They'd realise how crazy it is to allow the far right, and this would wipe them out. But you're telling me contraire.
Oh, contraire, for sure, Michael. I think usually when you lose one election badly, you don't rush to another election soon. And this runs contrary to what all of us political scientists think your general strategy is. You usually wait to a better time and you give yourself an opportunity to develop good policies or see if the economy changes, or you wait it out a bit. You don't tend to go charging into a national election just after you've lost another election rather badly. So it was an astonishing decision, and I can't see how it can pay off. All the polls are suggesting that he's going to cop an absolute flogging. In the case of the British election, which we might touch on at some stage, they had no choice. They had to go this year, and they've gone slightly early, but they had to go this year. Whereas in the case of Macron, he could have waited another couple of years.
Mark, mentioning the Brits and the forthcoming election there, where the pundits are and opinion polls are all suggesting that Keir Starmer and Labour will take government, suggests a shift to the centre-left, perhaps, if not just around about the centre. But in Europe, we're seeing a lot of press, Italy, now France, in different parts, suggesting that there's a decided shift to the right. Is that the on-the-ground sense that you were getting while you were there?
I think that this is happening in many parts of Europe. There's a range of reasons for it. Principal amongst that is dislike of immigration, concerns about immigration numbers and perhaps some lack of integration of minorities. They tend to be front and centre amongst those concerns. But of course, these things are always elevated during tough financial times. And like many other parts of the world, the cost of living is rising and housing and other basic groceries and the like are expensive, energy is expensive. And that's when immigration is under the spotlight because of that.
Martin, we'll come to Mr. Dutton and the coalition's announcement about where they'd like to have a whole lot of nuclear reactors generating energy in Australia before long. That announcement in Australia seems to be accompanied by a state of mind which probably has never gone away, that coalition members don't, in their gut, actually agree with the Paris Agreement. Is there a sense that these countries in Europe are also becoming a little bit tender about subscribing to what's required?
It's more accepted in Europe. It's been hard for us to understand. We're still spending a lot of time debating climate. Let me give you an example. I caught trains to Lyon and Marseille, and they're beautiful trains. They run at 300 kilometers an hour. And they've actually banned short flights where you've got good train access. So you can't catch a flight between two cities, which is under 2 hours, if there's good direct train services. And so they're well ahead of us in thinking about the implications of climate. And when you think about this, it makes a lot of sense because I've caught a plane between Paris and Lyon and I've caught a train. And there's actually not that much difference in time. It's just that with planes, you've got to get there well beforehand. You've got to go through your security arrangements. There's things that you can and can't put on the plane, all of those sorts of things. It's a hassle. You can get there 5 minutes before the train goes and you're fine. So, I just think it's a bit of a no-brainer. We don't have that kind of regional train services in Australia. Now, granted, we don't have the same population. It's a very different scenario, but they are on the front foot, I think, with a lot of these issues.
Martin, if Marine Le Pen's party wins, as you're suggesting they will, or at least that they'll be in a controlling faction that controls the government, there'll be a new prime minister, even if there's not a new president. As you say, Macron stays in his position for his constitutional period. But there's talk it could be this young kid out of Le Pen's party who'd be the prime minister.
He's in his 30s. I think he's going to be the youngest prime minister for several hundred years.
I thought he was 28.
Oh, there you go. I knew he was young. You corrected me. It's astonishing, really. There's also the other thing that's really upended what I thought was the case in going over there. It appears that a lot of young people support the Le Pen's party in France, which you wouldn't normally expect. Here in Australia, the far right do much better, well, One Nation do much better with older voters, and that's really clear. But over in France, I think they're attracting a lot of younger voters as well to Le Pen's party.
So, for that younger voting bloc, what do you think is the key, if there is a single key issue?
It would be economic in many respects. So they're not wedded to a lot of the major parties. And we think our major parties might be struggling a bit with in terms of appeal, Michael. But I can tell you the Republican Party, for instance, which is the party of De Gaulle and the party of Chirac. If anyone's followed French politics, this is the absolute Rolls-Royce of political parties in France. They are an absolute mess. They're in such a bad state that you had the leader of their party suggesting they join Le Pen's party, and no one supported him in their party, and he locked them out of the building where their national administrative office is and barricaded themselves, and he still had control of the account, and they're in an absolute mess. They're trying to get rid of him, their own leader, like in the midst of an election campaign. I mean, they're going to get wiped out. They've performed poorly in recent times anyway. I think Macron cannibalised what was left of their vote. But that's how bad the major parties are travelling. The only other sort of grand party in France was the socialists, and the left has recently become very fragmented, and they've got four different parties which have agreed to join together. That might help their cause somewhat, but we've got two relatively stable major parties. Their parties are an absolute mess. So the centre is in many cases hollowed out. In France.
Martin, here we are in Australia, in Fremantle, where we look at the Indian Ocean. We can sort of direct our gaze where you've just been to Western Europe and take in the whole of Europe, in fact, and contemplate what's going on in that part of the world. But we bring our vision back a little bit and look directly north, and we see Beijing shining And the Premier of China, Li Qiang, has just been making a panda diplomacy visit to Australia and meeting our Prime Minister Elbow in the Great Hall in Canberra, in Parliament House, having a no doubt a 15-course Chinese meal with a few ribs on the side. Have we made up with China? Are they our best mate?
Look, we've made fairly significant strides towards a closer partnership in recent times, which is a positive, especially for those areas that like to trade with China. But I would still say there's some unease. And if you want an example of that, there was that big kerfuffle around Cheng Lei. That's that former journalist that got imprisoned in China for your listeners, who after years of imprisonment, we managed to get back to Australia. Our government lobbied very hard for that. She's now a journalist with Sky News, and their embassy officials, their officials tried to block her from being seen in footage of the Chinese Premier's visit.
She's
And
tiny and tall.
look, the weird thing is these sorts of things are, they look really clumsy and ham-fisted.
Stupid.
Like, they look half-baked. Like, it's very weird. I don't know if you remember the Olympic, remember the Olympic torch a few years ago where they tried to stop any protests around the Olympic torch ahead of the 2004 Olympics, and it was all messy. And I think the more you try and crush dissent in Western liberal democracies, the harder, the worse it looks. Anyway, but it was just a reminder that we are very different communities and societies. And I think that there's a desire from both sides to work more collaboratively together and to get along better. But there's also a recognition that there are still some substantive differences there.
Martin, we've got ourselves to Canberra. We'll step out of the Great Hall, having had that huge meal, and now we've got Mr. Dutton announcing that he wants to put nuclear power reactors where there are currently going out of fashion coal fired power station. One of them in Western Australia, of course, Muja Poly. No real attention to cost, some attention to when they reckon they can build these things, about which there's a lot of doubt. Is this just posturing? Is Mr. Dutton looking at France and Western Europe and the shift to the right and thinking this is his ticket home back to government in Australia?
Well, it's been really, really fascinating. It's a very bold move. I think Yes Minister would call it courageous. It's a massive policy announcement that's going to cost many billions of dollars, and it's some decades away. So it's a fascinating thing to put into the mix for the opposition leader, and it carries a massive risk. So I think the Albanese government was struggling a little bit around costs of living, and the coalition was level pegging with it. Now all of a sudden the narrative's changed, and they'll be a big target around this. Now I think there is it, look, it's an interesting policy idea. I think the main conversation first and foremost is around costs, and that's what is occupying a lot of people at the moment. Expect it as the election gets much closer to shift to the politics of this, in particular the politics of this in the communities that will be impacted. So there's seven sites which have been named, one here in Western Australia in Collie, and I would be really surprised if those communities are really excited about having a nuclear reactor on their doorstep. And a lot of the there'll be a lot of focus around those areas, I expect, in the lead up to the election. So that's another big, massive political hurdle they're going to get across. But there's a range of different policy questions which remain unclear at the moment. So how much are these reactors going to cost? What about the infrastructure that comes with those reactors? What kind of consultation there needs to be before they are built? What is the impact on, in your actual household charges? A lot of the commentary at the moment is quite skeptical about this driving down prices, and a lot of it is suggesting that nuclear energy is actually more expensive than a lot of other forms. And certainly, if it costs $100 billion to get it going, Michael, it will be expensive.
Well, we're still really in many ways from the current government's endorsement of the previous government's endorsement of the AUKUS arrangements. And a lot of people wonder just what Labor got themselves into in doing that. There's also been commentary during the week suggesting that while Mr. Dutton is a masterful commentator and Anthony Albanese is anything but, that really what's behind the nuclear power announcement is this realization that if you go into the coalition party room and scratch a few people, you'll find that actually they're still climate skeptics. Do you think there's anything in that?
There's certainly something in the fact that a lot of people in the coalition are not fans of renewables, and this opens yet another front on energy uncertainty. There's a potential for it to scare away some investors in renewables, given that there's this great big alternative energy policy sitting there. I don't know if that eventuates or not. I'll give one thing to, that is clear in its favor, in that it is actually net zero once you get this up and running. So it is theoretically at least a passage towards net zero policy for 2050. But if you actually talk to, again, to energy analysts, they'll say this would be at best one component in an energy mix. It wouldn't provide all of the energy that we need. So it might replace coal-fired power plants, for instance. But that would also mean that those coal-fired power plants would have to operate a lot longer than we would otherwise have them operating until these plants come on board. So the picture is, eventually one day it could help solve it, but it would actually be several decades of still burning coal in the meantime.
No one much is talking about the safety aspects and what a spill or a leak or goodness forbid it, anything greater than that would mean if you have lots of nuclear power stations around the country. Gabriel Chan, writing in the Guardian, asked what I thought was a pretty good question. Would you say, what would you say, what do you think the answer would be if you asked people in these regions, would they prefer to have a nuclear power plant or a wind farm? You'd think it'd be a bit of a no-brainer so far as the answer's concerned, but that raises the question: is the coalition's announcement on nuclear reactors grist for the teal mill?
That's a, no, an excellent question, Michael. I think it's yet another signal that they're not really interested in getting the Teals back, Teal seats back. One of the Teal MPs, the MP for Northern Sydney, has actually probably lost her seat because it's disappeared in a redistribution. Another Teal MP, Monique Ryan, has had her seat gradually massively reorganized, shall we say, in Victoria. So there's a few changes there, but I would be surprised if this is going to excite the Teal voters at all, and that I think that the renewable energy is much more popular in those areas. So I think it's another signal that they're probably looking for outer suburban votes more than inner city votes for this next election.
You think it's inevitable that there'll be more teal-like, teal-looking, actual teal candidates running independently at the next federal election?
There'll certainly be a couple of areas where they haven't run that they'll have a crack, and I'd expect that. The other ones that you might see pop up, which will be really interesting, if I was an aspiring politician and I lived in one of those seven communities that are proposing nuclear plants, and most of them are, not all, but most of them are in coalition-held seats, actually, you'd definitely have a think about it, wouldn't you? You'd definitely have a crack at it because you could get a lot of traction on that one issue, I'd imagine.
Yes, well, Collie may well be the new Margaret River in the southwest. Somebody will run for sure, Martin. Well, it's been fabulous as always talking to you. Welcome back to Australia, where the politics are real, Martin. They're just not running around having EU type elections and digging up truffles and drinking wine and looking at the magnificent south of France coastline. You're back to reality. So look forward to seeing you again next Friday.
Back to reality. Michael, but good to be here with you.
See you for now.
Take care.